there is a huge mess in this area because we received at the same time plenty of patients coming with a lot of papers with microbiota testing, which are totally different each other, with a lot of informations, with suggesting probiotic therapies. So there was a huge mess in this area. So from one side, we wanted a standardized approach to this. From the other side, we needed to have a kind of regulation of this chaotic landscape. And this is why we developed this consensus initiative on the microbiota test.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics. We're a non-profit scientific organization, also known as ISAP. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. In our podcast, you'll hear about emerging topics across the fields of biotic substances and microbiome science. I hope you enjoy this episode with your hosts, Professor Colin Hill and Professor Daniel Tancredi.
Hello, everybody. My name is Colin Hill.
And I'm Daniel Tancredi.
And today's guest on the podcast, we're delighted to have Gianluca Janeri from Rome in Italy. And Gianluca, you're a gastroenterologist. Can I start by asking, in your training as a gastroenterologist, I mean, I assume you did gastrointestinal infections and foodborne infections and things like that, but was the microbiome a module? Was it taught during your training, or is it something you came to as a working gastroenterologist?
Yes, basically, I didn't start my postgraduate training with the aim of becoming a microbiome expert. I wanted to become an endoscopist. But I came across into microbiome because this postgraduate school in gastroenterology has been always strong in this field. So I came across thanks to my mentors. Then I liked it very much, also because it helps you in opening your field of interest from, microbiota came across extra GI disorders, infections, cancer, neurological disorders. So it was very helpful to avoid any kind of boring. So this is why I concentrated myself into this. Then I had also had always, I say, a kind of interest for all the basic science, but I didn't find my basic science field that I can pursue as a clinician. Then I found it. So this is these are the reasons why I chose microbiome as my field of interest.
And I assume as a scientist, as a clinician, you'd normally be skeptical of things. When you hear something, you want to know, well, what's the evidence for whatever someone's telling you? What was it about the microbiome? What was the kind of evidence that made you think, this could be something that I really want to get into?
Well, usually the research process is always an iterative process. So you always start with a clinical observation. Then you try to find an association. Then you try finding a mechanistic explanation of this association. And then you come back to the clinic because you have to validate and synthesize in clinic what you have observed in the preclinical field. Basically, I started with a very simple clinical observation. So the fecal microbial transplant we pioneered in our center was basically very successful in curing the recurrent C. difficile infection. But when we look at the other data in other chronic or non-infectious disorders, it was much less effective. And this was a first step. Then in 2020, we started as a randomized trial on FMT in patients with the chemotherapy-dependent diarrhea. And we observed that the clinical success was associated with the engraftment in the recipient microbiome of the in the recipient gut of the donor microbiome. So we said, okay, let's follow this observation and try to study which is the basically role of microbial engraftment in the success of FMT. We demonstrated in a more established way in a paper published in 2022 with Segata Lab in Native Medicine. And then once we observed the importance of the microbiome evaluation of the microbiome profiling to assess the clinical response, then we said, okay, we need a kind of tool, and we need to standardize the tool to diagnose microbiome and to profile the microbiome for clinicians. Also, because there is a huge mess in this area, because we received at the same time plenty of patients coming with a lot of papers with microbiota testing, which are totally different each other, with a lot of informations, with suggesting probiotic therapies. So there was a huge mess in this area. So from one side, we wanted a standardized approach to this. From the other side, we needed to have a kind of regulation of this chaotic landscape. And this is why we developed this consensus initiative on the microbiota testing.
Can you talk to us about the challenges when there's reasons to think that microbial profiling may be helpful, especially for patients that are getting chemotherapy and they're having a disruption to their GI system? But when you're having just patients come to you and just want to know if it's worth their while to just get a profiling, what are sort of the challenges there that you'd like to emphasize?
We have different challenges. There is different levels. One level is very technical. So there are plenty of testing that use non-state-of-the-art approaches, like still they use some PCR or even some culture. So we stated that the only way to have a microbiome testing could be the amplicon sequencing or the shotgun sequencing. The PCR can be reliable if you want to look at pathogens, but it's not a microbiome testing, it's another thing, but can be useful anyway. There is also some other technical issues like the quality control or the control group. There is also a reporting issue because the reports are completely different each other. There is no testing with a similar report to others. Finally, there is some cultural challenge, because the real challenge is that the most of the testing now are done for health curiosity, just for the heritage test, DMEA testing. We want to move this field to make this kind of testing like the genomic testing we use in oncology to personalize the therapy. It's obvious we need evidence, but the evidence is mounting now.
I guess, Gianluca, what people might not fully appreciate, and is it almost a kind of a difficult thing to admit, because I'm also a microbiome scientist, that if I had a blood sample and I sent it to your lab for analysis, or I sent it to a lab in the US or sent it to a lab in Japan, I'd expect to get the same results back from every one of those labs. I'd expect the same with genetic testing. I'd expect identical, reliable results. But I could send a sample, a fecal sample, to very, very accomplished and good labs, and yet get very different results back because of variations in techniques and standards and so on. It's not disparaging any of the labs. They're all doing very good work. But how far away are we from getting to a point where we can develop standard protocols that would allow a lab in Japan, a lab in Ireland, a lab in Italy, a lab in California to come back with the exact same results for the same sample?
Well, this is an interesting question. Basically, we have several initiatives that are trying to standardize this. For example, the STORM checklist aims to provide a kind of reporting in microbiome trials, observational or interventionals. We have also other initiatives that establish it very technically, which are the standard for microbiome sequencing and analysis, but also including the sample collection, for example. So we are still far from getting it into clinical practice. So I think some years are needed yet, but we are definitely closer than a couple of years before.
But I guess a big difference is that, you know, based on the blood tests or the genetic tests, you can make very valid clinical decisions of how to treat an individual. Based on microbiome testing as yet, are there any clinical decisions that you can make based on a microbiome test? Because if there are not, then it doesn't really matter what results they give you back.
Well, nowadays, for the data that we have, there is no clinical decision we can take because of the microbiota test. But there is increasing evidence that shows that the microbiota testing may be a reliable tool to help us in making a clinical decision. I think the field which is closer to clinical practice is oncology. There are a lot of amounting evidence showing that the microbiota can help in predicting the colorectal cancer with a very high level of reproducibility across different countries worldwide. And there are also increasing evidence showing that the microbiota profile can predict the response to immune checkpoint blockade. So I think in 5-7 years, we will have some microbiota testing in clinical practice for these clinical condition or questions.
Yeah, it's a challenging situation because Colin had asked you earlier about your exposure to the training, and you're fortunate in that you've been more exposed than GI docs to the appropriate training. But there's also the technical issues with getting a proper profile. If all of those are taken care of, you know, we have better trained GI docs going forward, we do standardize the testing, there is still that big challenge that if all you know are which taxa are shifted from healthy controls, that doesn't necessarily tell the physician what he or she needs to do to fix that. And then the other challenge that Colin and I think about a lot is that just because one taxa is off, there might be another taxa that's compensating functionally for that. So what you really need to know is enough about the functional relationships to know if a change in composition is relevant or not.
Yes, this is totally an important point. So the physician will surely become more trained when there is a reason to be trained. So basically, I think the relevance you're mentioning should be a clinical relevance, because I can have all the changes on the shift, but if the individual, the patient is healthy, I don't care. While doing first association studies and that proper association studies, and then mechanistic and interventional studies, I can associate a condition to a microbiome profile. And then I don't care. I can even don't care if there is a connection, a mechanistic connection. I need just the diagnostic association. So I can produce a very easy profile to be read by the physician. But I need a strong association. This association is going to be relevant in, as I told you before, in CRC, in colorectal cancer, and also in immune checkpoint blockade. But I think definitely we need this evidence to be more established. But when we will have it, basically also the physicians will follow.
And I assume, Gianluca, that, you know, generating lots of information from a fecal sample or a swab is now pretty trivial. We can get hundreds of millions of sequences representing the microbiome, representing the individual bacteria within any sample we choose. Do you think we'll need further developments in things like AI and artificial intelligence to interpret those kind of genetic sequences, as Dan said, turn those into kind of more functional readouts of what enzymes are present, what proteins are present, you know, what might be missing in that person's microbiome or what might be present in too high an abundance?
Well, I think this kind of AI means basically with microbiome is machine learning. I think we need it in the process of developing the diagnostic tool. Once we have it, the diagnostic tool should be very easy to interpret, because I remember one reviewer told me clinicians are busy people. They need a very simple test. So basically from large connections, we have to basically develop a very simple test, very straightforward. Mm.
One of the things I admired about when I got involved with medical research is that I realized that my physician colleagues don't necessarily need information if they don't know if they can act on it. And I think that's admirable. Like, don't do a test if the result of the test isn't going to lead to any clinical decision. So we're in a situation where as we get more knowledge, the test data may be helpful for people in the future, but right now it's not helpful for people right now. So what would you summarize as sort of the main points from the consensus paper that you would want your patients to know?
Basically, first of all, this testing should not be self-prescribed because they are usually expensive. They can bring you to basically no clinically relevant information. If you do for your health curiosity, you can do, but there will be some evidence in the future. For example, we have observed that a microbiome profile can drive you to target the therapy in a patient with post-infectious irritable bowel syndrome. But if you are prescribed with a test, remember, but this is more for the physician, if you prescribe a test, remember that the test, or if you analyze a test that the patient brings to you, remember to check first if they have used a buffer for genome preservation to collect the sample. If they have done a kind of sequencing, which is amplicon or shotgun, whatever. If they have done a full microbiome profile with at least a genus at the lowest level. If they have included some post-report prescriptions. This is a kind of checkpoint that should tell you that this test is not useful because usually there are some companies that from one side sell a diagnostic line, from the other side sell an interventional line, and they combine. And this is basically not ethical.
And again, I'm going back to my blood analogy again. I would assume that blood chemistry of healthy people is relatively similar and relatively stable. But we know that microbiomes can be highly individualized, that in different individuals can have very, very different microbiomes, but they could be healthy in those individuals. Do you think that the individuality of microbiomes will kind of always make it difficult to make clinical decisions based on a single microbiome profile? Or do you think you'll need multiple profiles?
We know there is very recent evidence defining the healthy microbiome. And so we have some pillars that let us describe a microbiome as healthy or not. For example, there is a consensus initiative from the Human Microbiome Action, or there is a paper from the Liping Zhao Lab that has defined a kind of yield for defining the healthy microbiome. And so we have a kind of some ways to identify the important pillars to define microbiome as healthy. But on the other side, we have also the most advanced technique, like the shotgun sequencing and maybe in the future metabolomics, that will help you show the functional profiling, which is very important then to associate the microbiological health with the clinical health.
Speaking of the future, can you tell us about some of the research efforts that you're involved in and that your colleagues are involved in that make you excited?
Well, basically, there is some very incredible evidence coming from different labs. For example, the CUNG lab, the Zitvogel lab, the Segata lab, the ELINAV lab, and many others. We are also thrilled by this discovery that we had that microbiome testing can help you in targeting the therapy. So not only using the microbiome to predict response or to identify very early a disease, like in cancer, but also to target very precisely the microbiome modulation.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. I mean, I was really struck by the Zitvogel paper and other papers that showed, as you mentioned earlier, that the type of treatment, whether you respond or not to a particular treatment like checkpoint inhibitors, is to a large degree dictated by your microbiome profile. That's an extraordinary insight into the role of the microbiome in human health. You mentioned that already, that maybe cancer would be the first place where the microbiome would become either diagnostic or stratify patients for different treatments. What do you think is coming down the line after that? What do you think the next types of diseases are that might be aided by microbiome testing?
Well, probably the IBD, because there is increasing evidence in the IBD field.
That's inflammatory bowel disease.
Yeah, inflammatory bowel disease. Sorry for non-clinicians. I also think, but it's more on the therapeutic side, multi-drug resistant infections are a very important target for microbiome therapy, also because it's very close functionally to C. diff, where the microbial modulation was proven to be very effective.
And the intervention that you mentioned earlier, FMT, which again, for people listening, is fecal microbiota transplants, literally involves transferring fecal material from a donor to a recipient. Is that sustainable in medicine, do you think, such a kind of an undefined transfer of material? Or do you think we have to get to a point where we have defined consortiums of bacteria that we use instead of FMT?
Well, if you follow the international recommendations, we have proven, but it's most from the European side, we have proven that FMT is very safe. So it's not a matter of safety, but it's not sustainable on another matter, which is the scalability, because that FMT is not scalable. It's very difficult to build an FMT center. It's very difficult to find and keep donors. So if you want to use microbiome therapeutics also in non-communicable chronic disorders, you need for sure to have another kind of therapy, which are probably the artificial microbial therapeutics, live biotherapeutics, or whatever you want to call it.
You spoke as well, Gianluca, about engraftment, about the donor microbiome engrafting into the recipient and remaining there for prolonged periods. And that always worries me a little bit because, you know, we try and associate the microbiome with all kinds of different diseases, and then we're moving a microbiome from one person into another one. What if we're delivering a kind of a propensity to get a disease later in life into that individual? It might be safe in the acute or short term, but how can we guarantee long-term safety when we still don't know what diseases the microbiome is involved in?
Basically, you have just to interrupt the microbial modulation because the engraftment is not long-standing. If you finish the engraftment, the donor microbiome disappears in some months. While if you go into the chronic therapy, the established, well-defined consortia are basically very safe because you know what you get.
Yeah. And Luca, thank you so much for sharing your time. Time has gone by so quickly. So thank you for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you. It was really an honor.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from ISAP. Check the show notes for links and further information on this topic. You can also send us your feedback, questions or topic suggestions by emailing info@isapscience.org. Don't forget to follow or subscribe to this podcast so you never miss a new episode.